I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Businessman Chris Hart had planned to announce his candidacy for governor of Pennsylvania today, though a funny thing happened on the way to the kickoff. After learning from WHYY about the qualifications for office, he quickly abandoned his bid for the top job in Harrisburg. Sounds strange? WHYY's Dave Davies explains.
If there's a checklist for starting a political campaign, one item would have to be, am I eligible to run? Chris Hart's a 34-year-old Republican who grew up in Montgomery County and has spent more than a decade in Washington, D.C., where he went to college, worked on a Senate staff, owned a neighborhood grocery store, and co-founded a program to help the homeless. He just recently moved back to Pennsylvania, where he said in an interview Tuesday he's ready to run for governor.
I'm very passionate about people. I understand policy, and I get politics. And so if you put those three things together, I almost have an obligation to serve the people I love for the issues that I'm passionate and I care about.
But it turns out there was a hitch in Hart's plan. Election lawyer Adam Bonin says the Pennsylvania Constitution has some requirements to run for governor. Here's one of them.
You have to, for the 7 years preceding the general election, be an inhabitant of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
That's a 7-year residency requirement. Hart moved back to Pennsylvania in May. When he heard about the requirement from us, Hart hastily changed his plans. He isn't running for governor now, but he'll keep his team and his website and continue meeting with citizens as he considers other options, including a run for U.S. Senate. That office does not have a prior residency requirement. There are already 4 Republican candidates in the primary to challenge Democratic Senator Bob Casey next year. Republican strategist Charlie Giroux says if Hart jumps in, he'll face an uphill climb as a newcomer.
For any candidate, voters are looking for somebody who has served them in other capacities, who has a record in the community, in the state, doing things for folks on a human level.
Hart says he has deep roots in the state and family throughout Pennsylvania and ideas he's sure will connect with voters. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Now 9 days into Bill Cosby's criminal sexual assault trial, jury deliberation ground to a stop today. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that the deadlock does not necessarily mean the end of the case.
When jurors announced they couldn't reach a consensus this morning, Cosby's attorneys moved for a mistrial. Judge Stephen O'Neill denied that motion and instead read part of Pennsylvania law intended to push jurors to make a decision. Legal consultant Mark Calzaretta says that law, called the Dynamite or Allen Charge, is meant to convince entrenched opposing jurors to compromise.
Now, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
If a jury really can't make a decision, the judge may read the charge again or allow a mistrial. But jurors may not know that right now, according to Calzaretta.
And it's kind of within their power to a certain extent to say, look, we just can't come to an agreement here. They don't know that if they come back a few more times that there actually will be a mistrial.
The jury's been deliberating for more than 30 hours. Outside the courthouse, Cosby supporters and Cosby accusers clashed in the middle of the day. Cosby's been accused of drugging and molesting Andrea Constant, a woman he met through her work for Temple University's women's basketball program in the early 2000s. In 2015, prosecutors charged Cosby with 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault, stemming from an incident at Cosby's suburban Philadelphia home a decade before. The jury said it couldn't agree whether or not to convict him on any of them. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
There are several ways to get a U.S. green card, giving immigrants permission to permanently live and work here. In some cases, people take care of the paperwork before leaving home. In others, everything's sorted out once they get to the United States. As the Trump administration continues to crack down on those in the country illegally, residents in the Philadelphia region from both camps are rushing to apply for citizenship. WHYY's Aaron Moselle explains.
On a recent Wednesday morning, the lobby of a Center City law firm buzzes with activity. The roughly 3 dozen attorneys here are part of the reason why. The rest comes from the green card holders who want to start the process of becoming a U.S. citizen.
I'm just trying to make sure I'm okay and I don't want anybody to try to deport me.
Roxanne Reed and many others reference President Donald Trump while explaining why they signed up now. But their motivations run deeper than the current political climate. For Maria Serna, it's about capping off a two-decade-long struggle to have a voice in America.
I want guarded the same rights everybody have. You know how you citizen, you have the right for vote, you have the right for go and travel, you can run for our office.
Serna came from Colombia in the late 90s with her husband and two kids. More than a dozen family members were already living here by then. It wasn't an easy decision. In Colombia, Serna had a career drafting buildings for an architecture firm. She had her own office. In the U.S., she knew her limited English would likely make it harder to have the same lifestyle, if it was possible at all. But with her husband out of a job and no real prospects, Serna says she knew it was time to leave. The family came over on travel visas with the intent to apply for something permanent. She was crushed when she heard she didn't qualify. She grew up in a household where doing the right thing was a family mantra. Now, to stay, she would be breaking the law.
I cry a lot. But in the final, I say, okay, I hear, and keep going.
Serna spent the next 15 years living here illegally. She couldn't get a job at any architecture firms, so she cleaned houses like her husband. Serna still gets upset when she thinks about the year she was here without an ID or papers to prove who she was. Now 56, she's finally in line to become a U.S. citizen thanks to a never-ending supply of determination. After doing her own research, Serna came across a provision of the so-called LIFE Act that gave her the ability to apply for a green card. Passed by Congress in 2000, the Legal Immigration Family Equity Act is aimed at giving citizens and green card holders the chance to reunite with family members that previously were unable to obtain legal status. Serna had to show her mother filed a petition to get her daughter a green card shortly after Serna arrived in the U.S. With the help of an immigration lawyer, she was able to track down that document, which had been lost. It was a big victory, years in the making.
I lost too many opportunities to have a better life, do the same things the U.S. citizen do, you know? That's like you live in a second-class citizen.
Serna says she'll be happy when she officially becomes a U.S. citizen, but not necessarily bowled over. She says she'll still be the same person on the inside. For others, that day will be quite emotional. While she was never unauthorized, Tapiwa's dizzying trek to the U.S. spanned three countries. She's pretty convinced the tears will flow at her ceremony whenever that happens.
I never thought the journey would be this long in general from, hey, I'm going to Australia, and wow, I now live in the U.S. How did this happen?
We're withholding the 34-year-old's last name because she fears going public with her story until she's officially a citizen. Tapiwa grew up in Zimbabwe, but when it was time to go to college, she knew she wanted to leave. She picked Australia to study communications. While she was there, her family moved to the U.S.,
because of the political situation and the financial situation that was going on in Zimbabwe, we were able to work with some of the lawyers to be able to get us asylum. And I was a derivative asylee at that point because I was under 21.
Zimbabwe was in a tailspin even before Tapiwa left. There was political violence and economic turmoil, especially in the rural areas of the country.
We started standing in lines to get bread. We started standing in lines to get the basics at this point. And just going from point A to point B, we were starting to run out of gas. So people would be in like fuel lines for days.
Tapiwa's journey to the U.S. wasn't exactly intentional. It's more the product of a pair of mishaps and a longing for family. Before arriving in America, the paperwork supporting Tapiwa's asylum status was mysteriously lost. That meant she couldn't travel to the U.S. until it was recreated.
So it's almost like saying, I have a green card, but I can't actually show you I have a green card.
Nearly 3 years passed before it all got fixed. By then, Tapiwa was working in South Africa, where a woman later stole the money she'd submitted to renew her work permit. But the timing was perfect, at least as far as Tapiwa was concerned. She was ready to join her mom in the Philadelphia suburbs. She hadn't seen her in 5 years.
It really started taking its toll on me, just very much so emotionally and just mentally. I just got to a point where everything felt incredibly difficult and hard to maneuver because I was on my own.
Tapiwa says she never planned to live in the U.S. These days, though, she's glad she's here, glad she finally has the opportunity to feel like she belongs. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Over the past year, eighth graders at Kirkbride School in South Philadelphia have been contending with a complicated question. What is the American dream? Well, this morning, they presented art inspired by their quest. More from WHYY's Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Once I came here, when I was breathing, free air. Like, it was a different air. Sometimes I'm speechless about it.
Marjorie Castajón immigrated to the U.S. 3 years ago from San Pedro Sula, an industrial town in Honduras once billed as the most dangerous city in the world.
But here, I feel free to go anywhere I want, and I feel like someone is not going to stop me for doing what I want.
Today she attends Kirkbride, where 4 in 10 students are learning English, and many more are the children of immigrants from East Asia and Latin America. It's one of Philly's most diverse schools.
Trust me, I never tried Asian food. And I came here and my friend Philip gave me dumplings, and I'm like, oh, this is so good. Like, how come I didn't try this before?
Because of its diversity, Kirkbride was an especially interesting place for artists from the nonprofit Cosa Cosa Project to ask students about the American dream, what it means, and whether it still exists. For some students, those conversations became poetry.
The Free Land by Kwee Thach. In case you forgot, the United States is supposed to be a free land, meaning you can do anything, be anything. So what part don't you understand?
Migrants by Jessica Gordillo. Immigrants, united, equal.
Other students contributed to a ceramic mural unveiled on the building's third floor. The three-dimensional display is dotted with symbols of Americana, like pizza, and symbols of personal aspiration, like a stethoscope. There to help cut the ribbon for the unveiling was Mayor Jim Kenney. But first, he delivered an emotional speech focusing on the obvious connections between this project and today's politics.
Try to cut out the noise, try to cut out the ugliness, and remember that in this city, you are respected, you are wanted, and we love you.
Margie Castajón's contribution was a ceramic hand patterned with green and blue to represent a map of the world. She said she made it because we have the world in our hands and we have to care for it. Even in this charged political climate, she still sees more good in her adopted homeland than bad.
My American dream is to graduate from college and be the first one from my family to graduate from an American college. And I think that I'll achieve that.
Avi Wolfman Arendt, WHYY News.
There appears to be a deal in the New Jersey legislature on a short-term fix to the state's school funding problem. The accord calls for a net increase of $125 million in aid overall. Helping us do the math is John Mooney, NJ Spotlight education writer, chief executive officer, and founding editor. John, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Glad to be here.
The devil is in the details. How does the arithmetic work?
Yeah, it is. It's not easy to figure out. Basically, there would be, the deal was the reach between Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto and Senate President Steve Sweeney, trying to, at least the main aim was trying to get some additional aid towards the 380-some districts that are underfunded, under at least the current funding formula. And this deal, and both sides had agreed that that was something they wanted to do, or both chambers leaders wanted to do. So this deal calls for about $150 million more dollars going towards those districts, $146 million to be precise. And 46 of that would come from districts that now are getting more aid than the formula calls for, and that's about 200 districts or so. Not all of them are going to be heavily impacted, but of those, about 200 districts or so that are getting more aid, $46 million would come from them into that pot of 146 for the underfunded.
In the general sense, how does this realignment comport with the intent of the School Funding Reform Act?
Well, I mean, it gets it closer. Right now, the Funding Reform Act, and it depends how you do the math on this, the state has been underfunding that by as much as $2 billion a year. And that started really after the second year after it was enacted, the last year of John Corzine's administration, and every year since under Governor Christie. So that funding formula has been grossly underfunded, you know, for close to a decade. And this is a step towards that.
One small step for a state, but put words to the contention of naysayers that in this case, Peter is being robbed to pay Paul.
The big issue, and they released some numbers today on how each district would fare under this. And it's important to note that this has not been approved by the governor by any means. And so this is somewhat speculative. But the Democrats put out some numbers on how districts would fare. And there are, you know, I haven't done the tally of how many districts, but there's certainly more than 100 districts that would see cuts, none more than 1.5% of their budget, which is, you know, where they capped it in terms of cuts. But that's, you know, that's not a small amount. And certainly there's a place like Collingswood, that's $100,000, $123,000. Gibbsboro, down your neck of the wood also, 68. These are jobs on the line, and it comes late in the season. I mean, they've already struck their budgets. Teachers have been hired for next year. You know, there's going to be some pushback, and there already has been. You're hearing it, NJEA, the teachers union. This is not a done deal by any means.
Though, as you mentioned, the governor, the work of Prieto and Sweeney has not been done in a vacuum. Christie has been paying attention, and some say nudging the process along.
Yeah, I mean, he's aware of it, and it's certainly... He put a deadline on these folks to come up with a deal that he could go along with. That deadline passed, but he had been in some talks. So he's certainly aware of it, and I think he's going to like some of it. I think he doesn't mind some of the cuts that are coming because I think he's always wanted to bring some more to the underfunded districts and namely take it out of some of the Abbott districts like Camden City that he thinks are overfunded. So there are pieces of this that he'll like, but I'm not sure it goes far enough for him, and I got a comment from his office today that, you know, is a bit cryptic, saying, you know, it's something that they'll put under review, but they have some questions about its fairness, so I think he probably wants them to have gone further. This is not over yet, and certainly the opposition of places, of organizations like the NJEA, which carry a lot of weight in this state, especially with the legislature as well. I'm still thinking this may go down to the wire.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, David.
NJ Spotlight education writer, chief executive officer, and founding editor John Mooney. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Ahead of Father's Day this Sunday, we've decided to share a story from WHYY's Common Space podcast. It's about a son's transformed relationship with his father's house. It's introduced by James Brunson, director of First Person Arts.
We all know that losing a loved one is never easy. Losing a parent is especially hard. And how do you cope with the loss of your father when there are reminders of him literally everywhere, including your own home? Here's Jared Bilski with a story that resonated with a lot of us.
When my dad died, there was a question about what to do with his townhouse. My sister, who lives in California, thought my then-girlfriend Liz and I should just live there. But I didn't want to do that for a number of reasons. I didn't want to live in my dead dad's house because I didn't want to be so close to the place I went to high school. I didn't want my future mother-in-law to be only 3 minutes away from my doorstep at any time. And I didn't want to constantly be reminded of the parent I just lost. Granted, I probably didn't handle my dad's death in what a therapist would call a healthy manner. But everything happened rather suddenly. Within weeks, my dad went from being a guy I saw every couple months to a terminally ill patient I was making medical decisions for. I wanted to scrub the image of my dad taking his last breath out of my brain. And I didn't really think having coffee in his kitchen every morning would help me do that. Of course, I couldn't argue with the logic of the move. My dad's mortgage was roughly the same amount as our rent that was rapidly going up each year. "Can you promise me this will only be temporary?" I said to Liz before agreeing to make the move. She promised, and she went out of her way to make it as painless as possible for me. She went in early and decorated the place so it looked like our old apartment and not my dad's house. Of course, there was only so much she could really do. Even with Liz's hippie curtains in the windows, it still kind of felt strange. You know, for the first year, I felt like I was house-sitting. Early on, I spent a lot of time wandering around the house, trying to picture what my dad's life was like, or conjure up memories of my own brief visits there. If I stared at the sofa long enough, I could actually see a hungover 25-year-old me sitting there sipping endless cups of coffee from the French press that my dad was so proud of. Eventually, I learned to settle in. And slowly, little by little, I actually learned to love the place. Not in spite of it being my dad's home, but because of it. Living in my dad's house allowed me to keep a small part of him alive and let me feel like he was taking part in the moments that his death prevented him from experiencing in person. And so many of those moments took place right in that very house. The bathroom sink is the spot where Liz placed a home pregnancy test and we watched as two solid pink lines told us that our lives were going to change forever. The upstairs bedroom is where I, along with some help from my Boston Terrier Luna, proposed to an exhausted nurse after a 12-hour-long night shift. And the coffee table in the living room is the very spot where Liz wrote the most beautifully honest tribute to a life, a tribute she distributed at her grandfather's funeral. After a while, my own family's memories took over. Now, when I look around the living room, I don't try to envision my dad's former life. I see my own daughter bopping around to I Want to Poop My Pants, a Beatles parody I'd sing to her on a nightly basis. Or Liz and I on the sofa, wine glasses in hand, catching up on the awful, awful backlog of DVR we had in our queue, Grey's Anatomy. But with a second baby on the way, we need more space. That's why, after 5 years, we're finally moving. It already hurts to think about leaving the place, partly because of all the memories we created there, but mostly because of my dad. Saying goodbye to my dad's house is going to feel like losing him all over again. Thank you.
Jared Bilski is a writer, comedian, and storyteller, and, of course, a father. You can find more Common Space podcasts on iTunes. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.